Full Circle by Edith Wharton. Published by Macmillan Education, a division of Macmillan Publishers Limited. Copyright Macmillan Publishers Limited, 2013. Part 7. Vizey showed no surprise when Betton announced his intention of dealing personally with the two correspondents who showed so flattering a reluctance to take their leave. But Betton immediately read a criticism in his lack of comment, and put forth, on a note of challenge, "After all, one must be decent." Vizey looked at him with an evanescent smile.
"You'll have to explain that you didn't write the first answers."
Betton halted. "Well, I more or less dictated them, didn't I?"
"Oh, virtually, they're yours, of course."
"You think I can put it that way?"
"Why not?"
The secretary absently drew an arabesque on the blotting pad.
"Of course, they'll keep it up longer if you write yourself," he suggested.
Betton blushed, but faced the issue.
"Hang it all. I shan't be sorry. They interest me. They're remarkable letters."
And Vizey, without observation, returned to his writings.
The spring that year was delicious to Betton. His college professor continued to address him tersely but cogently at fixed intervals, and twice a week 8 serried pages came from Florida. There were other letters, too. He had the solace of feeling that at last abundance was making its way, was reaching the people who, as Vizey said, read slowly because they read intelligently. But welcome as were all these proofs of his restored authority, they were but the background of his happiness. His life revolved for the moment about the personality of his two chief correspondents. The professor's letters satisfied his craving for intellectual recognition, and the satisfaction he felt in them proved how completely he had lost faith in himself. He blushed to think that his opinion of his work had been swayed by the shallow judgments of a public whose taste he despised. Was it possible that he had allowed himself to think less well of abundance because it was not to the taste of the average novel reader? Such false humility was less excusable than the crudest appetite for praise. It was ridiculous to try to do conscientious work if one's self-esteem were at the mercy of popular judgments. All this the professor's letters delicately and indirectly conveyed to Betton, with the result that the author of Abundance began to recognize in it the ripest flower of his genius. But if the professor understood his book, the girl in Florida understood him, and Betton was fully alive to the superior qualities of discernment which this process implied. For his lovely correspondent, his novel was but the starting point, the pretext of her discourse. He himself was her real object, and he had the delicious sense, as their exchange of thoughts proceeded, that she was interested in abundance because of its author, rather than in the author because of his book. Of course, she laid stress on the fact that his ideas were the object of her contemplation. But Betton's agreeable person had permitted him some insight into the incorrigible subjectiveness of female judgments, and he was pleasantly aware, from the lady's tone, that she guessed him to be neither old nor ridiculous. And suddenly he wrote to ask if he might see her. The answer was long in coming. Betton fumed at the delay, watched, wondered, fretted. Then he received the one word: impossible. He wrote back more urgently and awaited the reply with increasing eagerness. A certain shyness had kept him from once more modifying the instructions regarding his mail, and Stretz still carried the letters directly to Vizey. The hour when he knew they were passing under the latter's eyes was now becoming intolerable to Benton, and it was a profound relief when the secretary, suddenly advised of his father's illness, asked permission to absent himself for a fortnight. Vizey departed just after Benton had dispatched to Florida his second missive of entreaty, and for 10 days he tasted the furtive joy of a first perusal of his letters. The answer from Florida was not among them, but Benton said to himself, "She's thinking it over," and delay in that light seemed favorable. So charming, in fact, was this phase of sentimental suspense that he felt a start of resentment when a telegram apprised him one morning that Vizey would return to his post that day. Benton had slept later than usual, and springing out of bed with the telegram in his hand, he learned from the clock that his secretary was due in half an hour. He reflected that the morning's mail must long since be in, and, too impatient to wait for its appearance with his breakfast tray, he threw on a dressing gown and went to the library. There lay the letters, half a dozen of them. But his eye flew to one envelope, and as he tore it open, a warm wave rocked his heart. The letter was dated a few days after its writer must have received his own. It had all the qualities of grace and insight to which his unknown friend had accustomed him, but it contained no allusion, however indirect, to the special purport of his appeal. Even a vanity less ingenious than Benton's might have read in the lady's silence one of the most familiar motions of consent. But the smile provoked by this inference faded as he turned to his other letters. For the uppermost bore the subscription, "Dead Letter Office," and the document that fell from it was his own last letter from Florida.